You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 327, The Old Testament Afterlife and the Psalms of Korah. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. Ready to jump into some, again, topical stuff. You know, I just love the topics. I'll confess here, but I like them a lot better than book studies. But you know, that's just me. Got to do a little bit of both.
Yeah. Well, since the book studies take, you know, a year thereabouts, right. I think we all enjoy these single topics.
Jude is next.
Right? Ruth, you know, we get some of these.
Right, we did Obadiah. So.
Let's just knock off all the low-hanging fruit and do all the short ones. That'd be.
Yeah. That'd yeah, still not take a bad us, idea.
That'd still take us, you know, I mean, we've got more than enough material.
Yeah, but you can call it a book study. So,
yeah, that's true.
True. Good way to cheat, you know.
Well, Mike, what are we talking about today? The afterlife.
Yeah, Old Testament afterlife and, you know, assorted related things, but specifically, you know, with an eye toward the Psalms of Korah. Now, you know, I have a big folder, you know, because once we were out of, you know, Exodus, you know, I was collecting things that I'd like to do topically. And again, if you haven't caught on to the logic here, you know, I do these topics to sort of, you know, get into the literature in topics that I know, you know, down the road, if there ever is an unseen realm too, that, okay, you know, we're going to include this, got to include that, got to cover this, got to cover that. So, I mean, I've got literally 18 pages, okay, of things that I want to do in a follow-up book again. And let me just qualify this, because I'll mention, you know, in interviews and here on the podcast, I'll say things like, oh, it's Unseen Realm 2 territory. Please do not conclude from that I'm working on Unseen Realm 2. I am not. This is all preparatory, you know, but it helps not to have to jump into so many things just cold that I've made notes on, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago. Hey, make sure you do this in the next one. Well, this is the chance to do that kind of thing. So I enjoy the topics because, you know, it gives you, the audience, a little bit of a heads up on, you know, hey, you know, we'll take a dive over here and do things that are related to this or that topic, you know, when we get there. Again, Lord willing, if there ever is a second book, then this is a heads up. And if there isn't a second book, well, you know, you got some information here, at least a little bit. So this is one of those. So it was prompted by my list, you know, dipping into the pool, but it was also prompted by something I got in email a week ago. I think that's fair to say. I mean, I knew I was going to do this, but this thing I got in email really kind of said, yep, good time for this. And that is, I got an email from my friend Tom Horn. He sent a link to a Yahoo News article, asked me what I thought, and we were blessed once more. The world was again blessed by the scholarship of Bart Ehrman. Okay, so on May 8th, Ehrman got something published in Time, at least Time Magazine Online. The title was What Jesus Really Said About Heaven and Hell. And of course, what Bart says is that, you know, the Jews of Jesus' day didn't believe in an afterlife at all. You died and that was it. I mean, you read something like that, and there are so many examples, not only in the New Testament, but outside the New Testament, so many examples to the contrary. I look at that and I just scratch my head like, is Bart writing this because no one will ever check, like in the popular audience, maybe? But, you know, there are people who have no theological commitments at all who would say, what? Like, what in the world is that? So I thought, yep. This is a good week, you know, to get into this, to show, you know, take a little bit of a dip. And we've done this before in Q&A, but a little bit of a dip into the contrarian material in this thing we call the Bible, the sacred scriptures of Jews and, of course, Christians. So I want to cover a few, you know, thoughts on this, specifically the positive afterlife idea in the Old Testament, you know, to be with the Lord. And as I've said before in Q&A and, you know, here and there, and where it's relevant in other episodes, you know, there are a lot of scholars, including, you know, evangelicals, you know, some evangelicals anyway, that suggest or say that there was no such thing as a positive afterlife idea in the Old Testament. I mean, they won't go as far as Barth to say like this wasn't even in Jewish consciousness, you know, of Jesus' day. I mean, that borders on the absurd, to be honest. But with the Old Testament, you know, there are a number of evangelicals even that will go this direction. So my launching point specifically is an article I came across a few months ago that I just sort of put in the hopper. It's by a scholar in Belgium named David C. Mitchell. And his article is entitled, it comes from 2006, so it's an older article, but the title is God Will Redeem My Soul from Sheol. Subtitle is The Psalms of the Sons of Korah. That's K-O-R-A-H, for those of you listening to whom the name might not be familiar. And this is from the Journal for the Study of the Old Testament, Volume 30, Number 3, 2006. And it's about 20 pages in that journal. So the article's title uses a phrase from these Psalms of Korah, God will redeem my soul from Sheol. I've mentioned certain Psalms before when we get these Q&A questions about the afterlife, but Mitchell has developed the phrase and the idea, its surrounding ideas and its context pretty nicely in this article. This is not publicly accessible, so I'll put it in the protected folder for newsletter subscribers. So this article, if you'll pardon the pun, ought to put to rest the idea that there is no positive afterlife in the Old Testament. Now, this is a narrow look. He's just looking at the Psalms of Korah. There are other things that we could talk about. For instance, would a people who really believe that you just died and that's it, no afterlife, really bury people with personal items? Like, would they really do that? Bart? Hello? No, they wouldn't. No, nobody does that who believes that idea. Okay, so you have archaeological evidence. You've got things outside the Psalms that refer to, again, the hope to be taken out of Sheol at some point and to be with the Lord. I mean, it's not just the Psalms of Korah, but this is where we're going to focus today to kind of narrow the episode. And even within the Psalms of Korah, I'm only going to really look at three Psalms specifically, that part of Mitchell's article, just to get us into this. So I'm going to read you the abstract, or at least part of it, from Mitchell's article. This is essentially what it's about. He says, after defining the Korah collection, this study shows that biblical tradition about the Korahites is marked by the theme of redemption from Sheol. Sheol, of course, the Hebrew term for the grave or the realm of the dead. This theme is discussed particularly in regard to the resurrection of the dead. Then an examination of the Korah Psalms shows that the theme appears there also. So he's, you know, the article starts a little bit wide, then he funnels it to these specific Psalms. Lastly, the abstract says correspondences are drawn between these traits of the Korah Psalms and the author's proposed eschatological program in the Psalter, you know, as a whole. So what Mitchell's going to do here is he's going to talk about some Korah Psalms. He's going to set the context first. Who was Korah, and why would this be a theme associated with his sons, who, again, are linked to certain psalms in terms of authorship? You know, why would that make sense? And then after he discusses that, he's going to say, hey, if you look at the whole Psalter, there's something eschatological going on in the way it's arranged. Okay, so I want to hit these things today. I think it'll be a good episode, again, just to provide some contrarian material to that wellspring of biblical scholarship, Time Magazine. Now I'm going to jump in here and I'm going to read a little bit from Mitchell as to how he gets into this as far as, you know, the context. So he writes, 11 Psalms bear the heading of or for the sons of Korah. They are set in two groups. The first group forms an almost complete sequence from Psalms 42, 49. Only Psalm 43 has no heading, but it can be taken as a Korah psalm because of its affinity with Psalm 42. They seem, in fact, to be one psalm, which has been deliberately split, perhaps to bring the Korah psalms up to the talismanic 12. Again, 12 is an important number. The second Korah group also forms a sequence from Psalms 84 to 88, but is divided by David, the Davidic Psalm 86. Then Psalm 89 comes immediately after the Korah collection to close the third book of Psalms. So Psalms 86 and 89, because of their editorial placement, and because they share, as we will see, other Korahite traits, should be considered affiliates of the group. Therefore, including Psalm 43, there are 12 Korah Psalms and two further Psalms which fall within their orbit, Psalms 86 and Psalm 89. The Korah collection opens Book 2 of the Psalms and, with the coda of Psalm 89, it closes Book 3. Moreover, the first group of Korah Psalms opens the Elohistic Psalter, that is, the group of Psalms 42 to 83 in which Elohim predominates, while the second Korah group reopens the Yahweh Psalms. Again, different divine names predominate in those two collections. The two Korah groups are separated by a group of Asaph and David Psalms, Psalms 50 to 83, and they're interspersed there. So, you know, that's a little bit of a summary as far as what the Korah Psalms that he talks about, you know, and we're going to talk about here are. And of course, it raises the question right away, well, which Korah are we talking about? Because the Bible has a number of Korahs, again, K-O-R-A-H in English spelling. So Mitchell summarizes this too, real nicely. He says, there are several Korahs in the Bible. The Edomites, Genesis 36, 5 and 16, again, has this. A Levite, Exodus 6, 16 through 21, Numbers 16, 1 and 1 Chronicles 6. And perhaps clans of Judahites, 1 Chronicles 2, 43, and Benjamites, 2 Chronicles 12, 6, you know, could be associated with Korah. The Korah of the heading is usually, though, again, in the Psalms, the Korah identified in the headers of the Psalms is usually identified with the Levite. Okay, so the one mentioned in Exodus 6, 16 through 21, and then Numbers 16. Mitchell continues, he says, this is because the Bible's only mention of the sons of Korah refers to this clan. That's specifically in Numbers 26, 11. Korah, the Levite, is the only Korah whose story is told in detail. The Korahite Levites were musicians and singers in the temple cult, and the Korah Psalms actually refer to their functions as singers and gatekeepers. As Levite musicians would both compose and sing, the question of whether these Psalms are of or for the sons of Korah doesn't really arise. The heading is probably best taken as simply denoting Psalms from the collection of the sons of Korah. Now, as a side note here, just in case it still isn't clear, this is the Korah who led a rebellion against Moses and Aaron. Okay, that's what Number 16 is about. And we're going to quote a little bit from Number 16 as we proceed. But this is that guy. Now, you know, if you remember the story, there's this rebellion against Moses and Aaron, and Yahweh, you know, the God of Israel, judges Korah and other people involved by opening the earth, and it swallows the rebels. They go down alive into Sheol. I'm going to read Numbers 16, and we'll start here in verse 30. Numbers 16, 30 to 33. Let's see here. But if the Lord creates something new, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord. And as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, this is Moses speaking, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up, with their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. So that Korah is the guy, you know, that the phrase sons of Korah is referencing. And you say, well, how? Yeah, it just seems really odd. You know, how's that a fit? Well, unlike the children of Dathan and Abiram, who were involved in this rebellion, the sons of Korah did not die in this judgment. And that is a note that is given to us specifically in Numbers 26 in verse 11. So I'm going to go to Numbers 26 here quickly. This is a reference back, you know, to Leviticus, or not Leviticus, but Numbers 16, the judgment here of Korah and his associates. So let's go back here. Numbers 26, 9, again, this is some genealogical stuff or some census stuff, numbering. And I'll start in verse 9. The sons of Eliab, Nemuel, Dathan, Dathan, and Abiram, Aviram. These are the Dathan and Aviram chosen from the congregation who contended against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah, when they contended against the Lord. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah when that company died, when the fire devoured 250 men. So there's a different detail. And they became a warning. Here's verse 11. But the sons of Korah did not die. Okay, so hold on to that thought. It's actually going to become important. You know, Mitchell, you know, says something to the effect that the phrase is really significant. The Korah event is like a sign, you know, pointing presumably to things to come. That, okay, you hear, why would we single out this group and make sure that people knew that they didn't die? I mean, you know, Korah and his other associates, they go down into Sheol, into the earth, and it swallows them up, and they of course die. They perish, as number 16 said. But then it has to make this note that, but the sons of Korah didn't die. All right, Mitchell spells out the implication here. Let me just quote a little bit more from him. He says, the sons of Korah, therefore, okay, because we have this specific note that they did not die, they didn't suffer the judgment that everybody else suffered. He says, the sons of Korah then were redeemed from Sheol. They were spared. The Reubenites, their children and their households, their own father's household, perhaps their father too, fell alive into the underworld. But the sons of Korah, who might have expected the same fate, survived. They bore this memory high on their heart, recalling it in their names. Now catch this. These are all relatives of Korah. And he's going to go through a number of names here that commemorate the fact that they were redeemed from Sheol. So they recalled it in their names. Korah's own sons were Elkanah, which means whom God redeemed, or the jealous God. That's Exodus 6:24 and 1 Chronicles 6:8-12. Also Asir, which is translated captive, Exodus 6:24. Their descendants were Nahath, which means gone down, also known as Toach, which means low down, 1 Chronicles 6:11 and 19. Zuf, which means to overwhelm, 1 Chronicles 6:20. Achimoth, which means brother of death, known also as Makath, taken away, 1 Chronicles 6:10 and 20. And Tachath, which means underworld. It's another word for the underworld. 1 Chronicles 6:9 and 22. So again, he goes through this list, and it's kind of obvious that the people who extend from, you know, Korah and his sons, you know, specifically his sons, because they're the ones who were redeemed from Sheol. They didn't die. They didn't suffer this judgment. They remember the event, and they name people in their family to be a reminder that we weren't sent to Sheol. We weren't left there. You know, we were redeemed from Sheol. He also says, you know, Mitchell points out at one point in his article that the story of Hannah, he says the redemption from Sheol is also hinted at in the Song of Hannah. He observes, and this is quoting Mitchell now, Hannah was a Korahite, perhaps by birth, but certainly by marriage to the Korahite Elkanah. Most of all, she is a Korahite in spirit. Like her Korahite forebears, she speaks of redemption from Sheol. Here's 1 Samuel 2:6. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and he raises up. That's the Song of Hannah. You know, 1 Samuel 2:6. Now, the question for the rest of our time, again, is signaled by Mitchell in this way. And here's where he goes through this background, and he's going to launch off into these Psalms. He says, redemption from Sheol is then a dominant theme of Korahite tradition. But what might such an idea have meant to its writers? And he says, you know, there's a range of possibilities. You know, what are these possibilities? Well, there's really, you know, fundamentally two. You know, one would be in regard to the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, any talk about deliverance from Sheol is always figurative for being rescued from physical death or danger. Now, it's fair to say that this is the dominant view of scholarship. Again, even evangelical scholars have bought into this view. And this is, in Mitchell's own words, an extreme. It's extreme. The other extreme, you know, the other view, I mean, if you're going to make them polar opposites here, would be to say that all the passages are talking about physical resurrection. He says that's also just not the case. It's, you know, that's an extreme as well. So obviously he's going to angle for the truth is really somewhere here in the middle. And let me illustrate the tension here with a psalm. I'm going to go out to Psalm 16:7. Now, this isn't something that Mitchell gets into, but this psalm always comes up in this discussion. So Psalm 16, this is a miktam of David, okay? And I'm going to read starting in verse 7. Now just listen to this. I bless the Lord who gives me counsel. In the night also, my heart instructs me. I have set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken. Therefore, my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Now, it's pretty obvious in verses 10 and 11 there. That was Psalm 16, 7 through 11. Verses 10 and 11, I mean, they get referenced of Jesus, okay, the Messiah. And specifically in the context of the resurrection. Now, there are those, again, to illustrate the tension, there's one side that would say, look, you know, in Psalm 16, this doesn't have resurrection in view at all. It doesn't have afterlife in view at all. What David is praising God for is deliverance from some physical calamity. I mean, the guy is always getting chased by Saul. He's got numerous enemies. People are always trying to kill him. So when he says, you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, it's a way of saying God won't let people kill him. God won't let him get killed. You know, he won't, you know, end up in the grave like this. Now, you notice, even probably in the way I'm saying this, that the question might pop in your head, well, that just doesn't seem really consistent, because if you're really taking it as the reference to Sheol as only physical deliverance from death, why not just say that the psalmist is saying something crazy like, you will never let me die? And of course, the answer would be, well, that would be silly. I mean, David's not going to think that. David knows he's going to die. So he has to be here just referencing God's protection in some time of crisis. Now, when Old Testament scholars say that, whether they do this intentionally, and some do, or not, they just sort of let it on the table and hope, maybe they hope people don't notice. But it creates this question of, well, then did the New Testament writers like misuse this when they use the psalm about Jesus, the son of David and his resurrection? Did the New Testament writers just abuse the text here? Because if this is what you're saying, that this text rightly understood means only physical deliverance from some danger, some calamity, then it sure looks like they're just, you know, pillaging the text, you know, like they're taking it out of context. Now, the other view, of course, would affirm that, no, they're not taking this out of context, you know, because, you know, these references to being delivered from Sheol in the Old Testament, you know, they do refer to bodily resurrection. In other words, I'm doing the polar opposite thing here now in the discussion. So they would go back to Psalm 16 and say what David's really talking about here is his own physical resurrection. Well, you know, that seems to be a little bit of an overreach too. I mean, maybe, you know, you will not abandon my soul to Sheol. I mean, I personally think that there's a hint there, at least a hint, that David hopes, maybe he doesn't like know, like I'm putting money on it, okay? But he at least hopes that the Lord will look favorably on him and remember him and remove him from Sheol. I think that's legit. But again, we're doing the polar opposite thing here. So people will try to force physical bodily resurrection into every reference like this. Again, my view is that some of them I think really do suggest this. And this is why we're doing this episode, because There is a Korahite tradition especially, but it's not just in Korahite psalms. This is Psalm 16. This isn't a Korahite psalm. But that have this hope expressed of being with the Lord. You know, at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. You know, telegraph to Bart Ehrman, if you're saying something like that, at your God's right hand are pleasures forevermore, you're not just thinking that when you die, that's it. You just aren't. Okay. So again, nobody at Time Magazine is going to fact check Bart. I understand that. I just kind of wish Bart would fact check Bart occasionally, because it's just such an exaggeration, you know, on the other side. But again, I'm hoping you get the idea that you have, again, these two polar opposite opinions. You know, I'm going to suggest that, you know, we don't want to overread the Psalms in either direction. But I think in Psalm 16, there is this hint again. You know, when David's talking about his Holy One, is David really referring to the eschatological Messiah? You know, probably not. I mean, he's the king. You know, he's chosen. He is God's, you know, elect, you know, that sort of thing, your Holy One. I mean, that idea, you know, could be, again, part of, you know, Psalm kingship language or something like that. I mean, people can try to make that. I think, you know, there might be a tangential relationship there, because if you remember An Unseen Realm, I have a whole chapter. I can't remember what the chapter number is, but I talk about how Adam parallels Israel, parallels, you know, David, parallels the Messiah, parallels Jesus. I mean, the servant is corporate Israel, you know, who also is connected back to Adam, who also is connected, you know, forward to the singular Messiah. I mean, all of these things are connected. These are interlocking. You know, it's the old, like I like to say, it's the matrix of ideas. So, you know, you can, you know, see kingship kind of stuff in a title like Holy One. But, you know, elsewhere, it's very clear that Holy One is a reference to God himself. And so, again, if you just do exegetical math along those trajectories, if David is referring to either himself as king, or again, you know, people would say it's an eschatological king. I mean, David obviously knows that God has given him a promise that his seed is going to occupy. It's the only one legitimate for the Jerusalemite throne. David's not foreseeing, you know, what's going to happen, the divided monarchy and the exile and all this kind of stuff. But you could do the exegetical math that the son of David is spoken of like this, and so is God. So like maybe those two thoughts go together. Because again, we've seen, you know, God is man, you know, in the Old Testament, God comes, you know, to his people, you know, he's trying to kickstart the restoration of Eden, you know, coming to be among his people. And it's very easy to, if that God is a warrior, to tie that into messianic stuff. I mean, this is how it works. This is how the messianic profile works. You don't get to just remove one element and call what's left the messianic profile. That's cheating. Right. But on the other side, you don't get to say things like, well, you know, David or some other Old Testament writer could see the whole picture. Like he wouldn't have needed hindsight like the apostles did. Well, that's way overstated too. So we don't want to be given, you know, to overstatement. So I think, again, you know, Mitchell's going to angle for this. I've already telegraphed this. I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. So Mitchell then, from this point, he talks about a few pages of ancient Near Eastern context. I'm just going to pull out two things he says here. He writes, our view of such issues, again, this afterlife idea, this deliverance from Sheol, our view on such issues should surely be influenced by what we know of Israel's cultural milieu. Well, that would be nice. Some form of resurrection belief was widespread in the Near East from early times. In Old Kingdom Egypt, Pharaoh was to rise to happy immortality in the Elysian field of rushes. Nearer to Israel, resurrection was familiar among the Canaanites in the second millennium BC. At the Ugaritic New Year festival, Baal, and his retinue of Rephaim, the deified royal ancestors, appeared from the underworld on chariots as the stars of heaven and the warriors of Baal and Anat. So in Canaanite religion, there was this belief that Baal, you know, died and then came back, you know, because he's the grain deity and all this kind of stuff. But they were familiar with the idea with Baal and the Rephaim that even though these royal ancestors had died, they were still living, okay, and they would come out annually. This was Canaanite religion, all right? So death wasn't just the end, even for Canaanites, is his point. Now, as a side note, in the, you know, the reference to Egypt, yeah, that's true of Pharaoh. You know, in the Old Kingdom, Mitchell writes, you know, afterlife was the prerogative of royalty. That's certainly true. But later, the lower classes increasingly expected and included the notion of a positive afterlife. And, you know, this is, you know, we have something called the Book of the Dead. The Book of the Dead is not just for Pharaoh. Okay. It expresses an afterlife belief among the Egyptians, you know, and it's also, you know, we also have to point out that, you know, even though Canaanites were thinking that there was life beyond the grave, you know, that's still not physical bodily resurrection. Again, we understand these things. Again, I'm saying this more or less for people who might listen to the podcast. But at the very least, what we're commenting on here is that bodily death was not the end, like no conscious existence. I mean, almost nobody's thinking that. The question is not, is there conscious existence in Sheol? Because like everybody's thinking that. The question is, will the righteous get delivered from the cadaverous existence of Sheol? And especially for the Israelite, you know, it's this cadaverous existence. And since the Israelites take a term like Rephaim and also associate it with the giants, you know, who come from the Nephilim and the spawn of Genesis 6 and the chaos forces and all that, you know, the if you're left in the underworld, that's a really unpleasant place to be, because there's, you know, for lack of a better term, I'll just use the later term, there's demonic guys down there. This is where they live too. So I sure don't want to get stuck there, is the point. So the righteous, again, in this context, are hoping for deliverance. They want to be removed from Sheol. So is that a legitimate part of Old Testament theology? Do you have this hope? You know, if you're, again, among the righteous, those who are you know, loyal to Yahweh, and, you know, I'm not going to lapse in a rabbit trail about believing loyalty. If you listen to the podcast or Red Unseen Realm, you know what we're talking about there. So circle back to our main question. Is the Old Testament exclude, this is another way of putting it, does the Old Testament exclude the idea of being rescued from Sheol after death? If you're Bart Ehrman, you say yes. But again, we're trying to look at the text here. So, you know, another way of saying it is, does the Old Testament in its talk about deliver me from Sheol include the notion of a positive afterlife? So it, does it exclude it? Does it include it? The dominant view, of course, he says, if you're in the Old Testament, again, we're not doing the Bart that all Jews, you know, didn't think there was an afterlife. That's just a hopeless exaggeration. But if you're Old Testament scholarship, again, most Old Testament scholars are going to say, nope, you're in Sheol. Everybody goes there. That's where you stay. Mitchell, and again, me, and of course, other scholars, we're not alone here, say that goes too far. So if we're correct, Psalms like Psalm 16 that get applied to the Messiah, the eschatological son of David, are not misinterpretations on the part of the New Testament writer. The New Testament writer is reading that psalm not only in hindsight, you know, of what happened with Jesus, but he's also reading it in the context of the matrix of ideas that are in Old Testament theology. So let's go to Psalm, a couple of these Korahite psalms. And again, for the sake of, you know, abbreviating the episode, you know, staying within a reasonable time limit here, we're only going to talk about a few of the Korahite psalms, specifically Psalms 46 and 48. You know, maybe drifting over into Psalm 49. We'll see as we go here. But the Korah psalms, again, recall the ancestral experience of the Korahites. They did not die when Sheol opened and swallowed up, you know, their forefather and other people. The sons of Korah did not die. They were redeemed from Sheol. So in Psalm 46, Mitchell writes, the deliverance seems to be by an earthquake, which is interesting given the number 16 context. But let's go to Psalm 46, excuse me, and pick up with a little of this. Just starting in the psalm here. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way. Okay, this is a psalm of Korah. We're not going to fear, though the earth gives way. Though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea. And that's actually a reference to Sheol as well, because Sheol was thought to be a watery, you know, place. It was the abyss, but there's also water there because it was under the earth. I mean, think Israelite cosmology here. Though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. Again, we're not going to be afraid. We're not going to be afraid. So you get this sort of earthquaking, earth shattering, you know, earth upheaval imagery. And Mitchell points out that the same verb is present here in Amos 9:5. Let me read you that. Okay, I'm just giving you an idea of what Mitchell does in this article. The Lord God of hosts, he who touches the earth and it melts, and all who dwell in it mourn. Okay, touches the earth and it melts. All of it rises like the Nile and sinks again like the Nile. So this up and down, you know, motion to the earth. Now, the reason why the Amos reference is interesting is because Amos 1:1 actually refers to an earthquake in Uzziah's reign. And Mitchell continues, he says, likewise, Psalm 48 tells how the invaders are seized upon by trembling, quote unquote. That is by analogy with Psalm 46, the trembling of the earth, Psalm 48, verse 7. Amid this cataclysm, Jerusalem stands unshaken. That's Psalm 46, 5 and 6, Psalm 48, 4 and 9, which makes known the name of God to all the ends of the earth. So Jerusalem is unshaken. It makes known the name of God to all the ends of the earth. Psalm 46, 11, Psalm 48, 11. Zechariah tells of the destruction of an invading alliance by an earthquake like that of Uzziah's time, which shall split the Mount of Olives and by plague, Zechariah 14, 4 and 5. Thereafter, all nations shall worship Yahweh. It is just such an event that Psalms 46 and 48 seems to anticipate, again, some cataclysmic earth-shattering event. As in Korah's rebellion of old, the fluid earth will convulse and reveal the gaping underworld of Sheol. Rebels will fall alive into the depths, but the righteous will be redeemed. Now, at this point, he goes back to Psalm 46. And let me read the verses that he references. Though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. It's a very clear, you know, Day of the Lord imagery here. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Now, that's the end of the psalm. Now, if you're a Korahite and you have this tradition of being delivered from Sheol, and Sheol is something you associate with earthly upheaval, like an earthquake, the earth splitting open and swallowing, you know, the sinners, okay? When you say, when that happens sometime down the road to Jerusalem, the Lord will be with us. See, we're the ones that didn't die back then, the sons of Korah. And when that happens again, when Sheol, you know, opens its mouth, we're not going to be swallowed then either. The Lord will be with us. Now, is that the kind of thing that someone who believes that you die and that's it would say? Of course not. Of course not. They're saying the opposite. They're expecting that God, again, will deliver them once more. If you go over to Psalm 48, this is God, our God forever and ever. Olam is the Hebrew word there, forever and ever. He will guide us forever. Now, interestingly enough, that's the ESV. The Hebrew has, he will guide us al-mut. Let me read the previous line again. Our God forever and ever is olam. He will guide us forever. It's not olam. It's a different phrase. It's al-mut. Now, a lot of English translations will translate that forever. And if you read the commentaries, basically they do that because they're following the Septuagint. That's the way the Septuagint translator read it. But if you keep the words separate instead of combining them, if you combine them, you can make an argument that it means forever. You know, al-mut, you put those two words together and you can sort of get olam with a T on the end. But that isn't the way the traditional Masoretic text has it. It has al-mut. It's a prepositional phrase. If you keep them separate, guess what you have? He will guide us above death. In other words, he'll deliver us from Sheol. He'll take us out. You know, Mitchell, of course, you know, spends a little time on this, and he argues that this reading is confirmed by Psalm 49:15. This is another Korahite psalm. Let's go there real quickly. Psalm 49:15, and it's really explicit here. Let's go back up to 14. Make it 13. So Psalm 49, 13 through 15. Just listen to this. Again, Psalm of Korah. The ones who were redeemed from Sheol. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence. Again, the stuff that's happened before. It's basically perishing, death, okay? Yet after them, people approve of their boasts. Like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd. And the upright... Now, okay, again, you know, this is an ermine flash here. Does the rest of the verse say, and the upright will be in the same place because everybody knows you die and that's it? No. Like death, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. It's going to swallow them up. But God, this is verse 15, but God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Now, that sure sounds like a positive hope of afterlife. In the Old Testament, God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. I mean, you can't just read the verse. Look at what it's contrasted with. Like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form, not our form, their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. That seems just abundantly clear. You know, Mitchell, you know, spends again a little time in his article talking about Psalm 49. You know, he makes a comment like, you know, it references Sheol three times, whereas no other psalm mentions it more than once. I mean, it's obviously a point of focus in this psalm. You know, God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. He will receive me. Interestingly enough, I mean, well, let's just think about it. If the point of verse 15 is physical deliverance only, this is tantamount to the psalmist claiming he'll never die. I'm not going to die. God's going to ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. Any physical threat out there against me, God's going to keep me from. Really? It just doesn't make sense. You know, Mitchell has a whole section of his article comparing some of the Korahite vocabulary, believe it or not, to Enoch and Elijah. And this is one of the points. Again, I'm not going to rabbit trail into this, but that last verse, Psalm 49:15, God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. He will receive me. The verb is lakach. He will take me. Lakach can be translated take or receive. It's the same verb used in Genesis 5:24. Okay, Genesis 5:24 ought to be familiar, you know, at least again to this audience. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God lakach him. God took him. He received him. You know, however, whatever way you want to translate it, it's the same verb. 2 Kings 3:3 through 10. Again, this is the Elijah episode about Elijah being, wait for it, taken by God. Okay, it's the same verb used in those verses. So this is what Mitchell does in the article. Again, I want to expose you to this. This is a very abbreviated form, and I'll admit, you know, this is a scholarly journal article. It's technical. But again, I'm still putting it in the protected folder because I think, you know, some of you can pick around the Hebrew stuff and still get, you know, a lot of benefit from it. But you need to realize that the next time you hear or see something on YouTube or the internet about how the Old Testament has no concept of heaven, believers being with God forever, and the New Testament does, and therefore the two testaments of the Bible are contradictory, just laugh. Okay? Just have a good time with that. You know, or lament. I don't know. Sometimes you don't know whether to laugh or cry. But again, this is why we're here, to expose you to this. Now, the last point that Mitchell makes, I think, is an interesting one. I'll toss it in here as we wrap up. He writes this. He says, within the context of the Psalter's eschatological program, the Korah collection's Sheol theme works in different ways. Low-key Sheol imagery first appears in Psalms 42 to 44, where it represents Israel's exile. Let me just stop there. So again, part of his article, he'll deal with how when Israel goes into exile, it's like a death. Okay. And so you get this Sheol imagery that, that gets attached to Israel going into exile. So it, it represents Israel's exile from which they long and pray to be redeemed. Psalm 45 represents the coming, catch this, just look at the ordering. And again, this is Mitchell's point. Look at the ordering of the stuff, okay? So Psalm 42 to 44, Israel, their her exile is compared to Sheol. Psalm 45 represents the coming of a bridegroom king, like the Mashiach, the Messiah. And that's actually in Psalm 45:8, that term. With the opening of Psalm 46, we begin to hear the distinctive rumble of the Korahite Sheol imagery. And that's where we've been today, Psalm 46, Psalm 48, Psalm 49. It tells of a cataclysmic day when, as in the desert of old, the earth will convulse and open up, revealing the underworld. In Psalm 47, after delivering Jerusalem amid cataclysms, the king, okay, the bridegroom king, receives the homage of the nations at his Jerusalem throne. Psalm 48 then returns to the Jerusalem deliverance. Let me stop there. Remember Psalm 48, Unseen Realm? The first two verses. Just read them to you. Psalm 48. It's good stuff. Great is the Lord, great is Yahweh, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. His holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, is the joy of the whole earth, or of all the earth. Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great king. Remember the chapter in Unseen Realm about Yarkatay, Tzaphon, the heights of the north? How that was language for Baal's council? You know, the seat of the gods in Canaanite religion, you know, the ones that they thought ran the show. Again, the psalmist says, nah, not so much. Now, the heights of the north is Mount Zion. That's where everything is focused. That's the center of the cosmos, as it were, as far as what matters and who is king. And, you know, who is in charge of history. You know, this is Psalm 48. This is in the mix of the Korahite psalm stuff and the deliverance from Sheol. So Psalm 48 then returns to the Jerusalem deliverance. God will redeem his people and carry them over death. Remember that Al-Mut comment we made? He will carry them over death. He will carry them above Sheol. Finally, to close the first Korah group, Sheol language appears full on in Psalm 49. Oh, yes, it does. Three times it's mentioned. Where the psalmist speaks for faithful Israel who will be redeemed from Sheol on that day. I mean, this was the hope of every Old Testament person. Now, of course, in this audience, we have mostly Christians here. And they're going to say, well, you know, that sounds like it's all day of the Lord and eschatological and blah, 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 blah. Okay, we're back to the already and not yet, because who is the bridegroom? Okay, it's Jesus. Okay, when do people get delivered? And why? It's the resurrection. I mean, this is where you've got to take the resurrection language. You've got to take statements of you know, Paul to be absent from the bodies, to be present with the Lord. You've got to look at scenes like the transfiguration, where, you know, Moses and Elijah, they're already with the Lord. Okay, it's not just all this stuff, you know, put into the remote future. Okay, there's lots of stuff going on both in Second Temple Jewish tradition and also in the New Testament that basically says that, you know, when the Messiah comes, and of course for the New Testament, the Messiah has come, all of this stuff is launched. It's inaugurated. It begins. It is already present, but it is not yet consummated. It's already, but not yet. Okay? So this is yet another one of those things that is presented in this dual way, already a reality, but not yet. I mean, there will be an end resurrection. There will be a day of the Lord. There will be this final judgment, the final resurrection, you know, on both sides. This is what we read in Revelation, okay? And again, that's consistent with day of the Lord language, all of that. But what we have to factor in is that there are certain scenes in the New Testament where you get Day of the Lord imagery quoted of the first coming and the resurrection and the ascension. But then you'll get other passages that still put it out into the future. That's because New Testament eschatology, and frankly Old Testament eschatology, is already, but not yet in its thinking. So again, I wanted to take a little time and do this topic because, yep, it's on the list. And you can see, again, this is just a little introduction, a little smattering here. Again, there are resources like, you know, Mitchell's article that, you know, in subsequent books, you know, if there's an Unseen Realm 2 or 3, I mean, we're going to drill down into different psalms and do this or that, you know, all that stuff. This is just a little bit, you know, getting your feet wet here. But even more so than that, this is the kind of thing that you need to remember when you're out there in the hinterlands of Middle Earth and you're running into Bart Ehrman, okay, and others who will dramatically overstate the position that they're fond of, regardless of the contrarian material. They just do that. It's just part of the game. So I wanted, again, to introduce you to this. You can pass it on to others, you know, get people to listen to the podcast, you know, certainly not only this episode, but others, but also just to have and, you know, to re-reference again when people need it.
All right, Mike, do you have any idea what we're going to be discussing next week?
I'll tell you what I'd like to discuss next week. No, this is kind of a really, I mean, okay, Trey, let's be honest. All of our topics are interesting.
But
I'd like to, you know, this is an odd one. And you know how we like odd ones, okay? Luke 24:42. Okay? Luke 24:42. Now I'm taking the time to read it for a specific reason because this is going to depend on your English translation, but it's really odd. This is Jesus, you know, when he appears to his disciples and he's cooking a meal for them, you know. It says they and you know, he eats as well. So this is like part of the resurrection proof. They gave him a piece of broiled fish and he took it and ate it before them. Now that's ESV. Some of your translations will add this phrase. They gave him a piece of broiled fish and some honeycomb and he took it and ate it before them. I'd like to do an episode on the honeycomb. And you think, well, what can you get out of that? Okay. Again, it's not in every manuscript. It's kind of like the John 5 thing with the angel, you know, troubling the water and all that stuff, you know, that isn't in a lot of translations. But this is actually a really interesting rabbit trail for those of you who have that phrase in your Bible. So that's what I'm angling for next time, you know, Luke 24:42. And really, it's going to take us into how the New Testament writers, you know, will characterize, you know, some parts of the resurrection and Jesus' body. So there you go.
Sounds sweet, no pun intended. So.
Oh, that's just, yeah.
All right, Mike. Well,
we need to insert a rim shot there, Trey.
I know, we need sound effects. I need to get on that.
Can you do that?
I could. You know, let me just pencil that in on all the list of things that I have to do. Add sound effects.
There you got a lot of pencils left.
All right, Mike. Well, we look forward to that one. We enjoyed this one. And now with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.